Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for another episode of KMXT 100.1 FM's Talk of the Rock. Joining us today is Yana Persley, a geophysicist with the USGS. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm quite well. So this might sound like a silly question, but for those of us here in Kodiak or living in the corner of southeast Alaska, which is an area that many people know is prone to earthquakes, but perhaps not exactly why. Could you give us a layman's explanation of why we have so many earthquakes in this region of the world?
Certainly. In this area, what's happening is the Pacific plate is basically diving under the North American plate. The Kodiak Island is riding on the North American plate. And so in the area where these two plates meet, that's where you get earthquakes, and they can be very large.
So tell me a little bit about the conditions that led up to the very large earthquake that we had recently, the magnitude 8.21. Last week. What sort of conditions caused that earthquake?
Well, all of these large earthquakes, they need a bit more time to build up the stresses between the two plates. Those two plates basically will be riding against each other. The Pacific plate is pushing under the North American plate, but the movement is not consistent. The two plates will be sort of locked together. Once the stresses exceed certain thresholds, that's when you release the locking portion between the two plates, and that's when earthquake happens. Sometimes they're smaller, sometimes they're massive.
So is it kind of like the plates have friction against each other, and then when they slip, that's what causes the earthquake?
That's correct.
Okay. So why is it that sometimes they're big and sometimes they're small? Like, why isn't the pressure relieved over a continuous period of time? Because we do have so many small earthquakes.
I think that has to do with what does it look like along the interface? You know, how much friction is there? How many sort of blocking elements are down there that are able to hold it locked for long enough until the stresses have to be such size that only the truly large earthquakes can break them apart. It probably has had to do quite a bit with geology as well. But along subduction zones, most of these very large earthquakes, they do happen along subduction zones because your faults can be very large.
So some people reported for the earthquake that we just had in Kodiak, sometimes the earthquakes are more of a jolt, and that's typical, but this earthquake was more of a roll, so to speak, something that really felt like a wave, like you might feel if you were on a boat on the ocean. Is there a reason for those different sensations that are produced during an earthquake?
From what I've heard from witness accounts is when the earthquake is close to you, that's when you feel more of the jolt. You will have the initial P wave and you will have the initial S waves, and those are higher frequencies, so you will feel the jolt. When the earthquakes are bigger and they are further away, what you feel, the rolling, the gentle rolling motion, that's the surface waves that are coming from a bit further away. And earthquakes the size of the 8.2, they can produce very large surface waves.
So and another thing that I'm curious about, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, when you have like a large earthquake like this, what does this say about the potential for future earthquakes of comparable size? Is it the sort of situation where the earthquake is like it relieves a lot of pressure, and then I don't know, for maybe a generation, you don't have to worry about a similar one of that size occurring, or is it completely random and there's just no way to know?
We cannot predict earthquakes when they happen. You know, if you have a large earthquake in one area, does that mean it's going to be quiet for longer? We really cannot determine that. Sometimes what happens is at the edges of the rupture area for these large earthquakes, you can have a future larger event. Sometimes when you have a large quake, you have increased chance within the next week to 2 weeks of earthquakes of the same size or larger. That chance tend to go down after the week, after the earthquake. But to be able to tell you if it's going to happen or not going to happen, we really cannot predict it.
Is there, and I guess this is sort of out there, maybe, dare I say, into the science fiction aspect, but is there any chance that we'll have some sort of technology that will give us the ability to predict earthquakes and their location and magnitude within our lifetimes?
I think it might take a little longer. I am not part of the research group of, let's say, geophysics, USGS. But, you know, these massive earthquakes, they do have very long, or they can have very long recurrence interval in terms of hundreds of years. And so, you know, does it mean that we have to observe them long enough to kind of understand the full earthquake cycle? Or will we be able to develop technology that's going to allow us to predict them sooner? I do not know. It's a great question, and it would be wonderful if we could predict them.
So another thing I was curious about, and I ask you this knowing that you're with USGS and not with NOAA, but I was wondering how the measurements that you guys have, how those are extrapolated by NOAA into making determinations about the potential for tsunamis.
So what happens with that is usually NOAA is the first authority that releases a magnitude. The early magnitude tends to be very quick. You have very few data points, and you try to determine really quickly if you are going to have a tsunami or not. Magnitude 8 earthquakes, especially in the subduction zones, they tend to have the potential of creating tsunamis or, at the minimum, local waves that can be fairly damaging themselves. With time, as we get more data, we can update the magnitude size, and then NOAA will take that into account, and they can update the tsunami warning information.
So this actually leads very well into another question that I had, which was, can you walk me through, like, say, I don't know, it would be perfect for this example if you were on shift during the 8.2 magnitude earthquake. But what I was curious about is what is sort of the process from the moment how these quakes are detected and what you guys do at the USGS to get that information out to the public?
So what happens when any earthquake comes in? We will have an alert because you will have detections on the closest stations. We have an alert with the first initial magnitude. In many cases, the magnitude is underestimated simply because you do not have enough data yet. We look at the event. We start analyzing the data. We start adding in more data. And we try to have a more reviewed solution within the first 15 to 20 minutes. By that time, we get preliminary magnitude from the very long waveforms, which are a lot more stable than the earlier magnitudes, and so then the event is released.
And is that the P wave, S wave differential?
It's actually difference between, so the early magnitudes are body wave magnitudes from the P waves, from a different P reflections. The solid magnitudes, or the more stable magnitudes, they come from the very long surface waves.
I see. So how are these actually detected? Like, I think a lot of people are familiar with the idea of the seismograph, but is it like, is there a network of seismographs distributed around Alaska that all trip at the same time that can give you information on this, or do you just have a handful? What is the monitoring for that like?
We have a number of stations in Alaska, along the Aleutian Chain, in southeastern Alaska, And then, of course, within the U.S. and globally. Some of these stations are part of USGS network. Some of these are part of the Alaska network. The global stations, the contributions happen from other countries and other local networks. When an earthquake happens, what the sensor is seeing is you will have, you know, your kind of background, noisy, up and down, sinusoidal waves just going along. And once the earthquake comes in, suddenly the sinusoidal wave just shoots up or down based on what the event is like. That difference between the background level and the sudden spike in energy, that causes an alert on that station. Now, when you get alerts on more stations around, you can determine where the signal is coming from. Once you kind of put together, or the automated system puts together, that there is a signal coming from one central location, then it starts trying to associate more data and calculate magnitudes and trying to look for updated depth and location solutions.
So for a quake like the one that we just had last week, how long after the first rumbling does it take for the first seismograph or monitoring station to pick it up?
I do not recall exactly the time. Let me open the event because I can look in the history for you, and I could give you exact timing of when the first solution was put together.
Sure, please.
Yeah. To give you a kind of an idea of how the system works in time, the magnitude 8.2 was detected by the automated system a minute and 45 seconds after origin time. The analyst basically looked at it immediately, and they worked the earthquake. Basically, they were checking that all the phases are fitting the solution. The earthquake was released at 17 minutes after origin time. So it took them the 15 minutes to stabilize the magnitude and stabilize the solution, have the correct depth, and have the correct location.
It's quite remarkable, in truth, that human civilization has reached a point now where we can make all these determining factors off of something that was, for the overwhelming majority of human history, considered to be literally the work of the divine.
Yes, it's impressive how quickly we can determine these solutions. The huge help in that, of course, is that we have so much data. The USGS and Alaska, the Alaska Earthquake Information Center, they have so many stations around these islands and in Alaska that helps you constrain the solution, and you can go very quickly to determine the location.
So here's another question that I had in regards to the way that the tsunamis are a track for large earthquakes, was that the this isn't my first tsunami warning, even though I've been living in Kodiak for only about a year now. And the earlier tsunamis, the predicted arrival time for the wave, and I think in both the cases that an actual tsunami was produced by an earthquake, in both cases it was a half foot tall wave, among them this most recent quake. Mm-hmm. And the first one, the predicted arrival time was like 2 minutes off. It was remarkably accurate. But for this more recent one, I think it was around or even more than a half hour. So what would cause such a large discrepancy between the estimated arrival time for a tsunami?
So just to put it more in perspective, I do not do tsunami warnings or determinations. But what I can see happening is tsunamis themselves, they come in series of waves. And if the first wave that hit Kodiak that was generated by the magnitude 8.2 was a lot smaller, then most of the detections were probably with the second larger wave. that could be one reason why there would be such a time discrepancy. Also, I do not know fully if there are any barriers between the 8.2 and the Kodiak Island that would have caused the wave to slow down. But again, this would be definitely a question for the Tsunami Warning Center themselves, because they know what goes into those estimations.
Okay, point taken.
Yeah.
Another question that I had was, so we just this morning around 1 a.m. had a magnitude 3.9 earthquake that was at a depth of about 2 kilometers. What I'm curious is that I was told by somebody in your office that this quake was unrelated to the quake that the large quake that occurred last week, and also at a very different depth. So could you walk me through sort of like I know you explained what causes like these larger quakes, but what I'm curious about is what causes such a difference in the scale and power and depth between two quakes?
It just, it can be the difference in the fault. It can be the difference between the different frictional properties along the interface. You can have a small sections of fault that go faster, because there are not so many stresses that would lock it in until you need the 8.2 to break it. With the 3.9, the quake is shallow too, so that can play into it. But you know, all along the Aleutian chain, from basically Anchorage by Kodiak and up to all the way to the Near Islands, you will have variation of earthquakes between 2.5 to all the way up to magnitude, like we've seen in the past near Anchorage, 9.2 actually, in 1964. So all the differences between them are how does the fault move and how much does it move by? That's kind of what determines the size.
I see. So how did you end up doing geophysics?
I've enjoyed geology, and I've enjoyed math, physics, you know, the sciences. And then I had a great professor in the college, and I got very interested in seismology.
And from there, you were just stuck with it?
Yeah, for me, it's, you know, you're looking at patterns and you try to determine what happened, where, and how, and it's very interesting. As long as the earthquakes are not damaging, the work is interesting. It can be very stressful when the big earthquakes happen in more populated regions that can be very bad very quickly, but it's an interesting job, yes.
It seems like a very forensic science.
Yes. We don't have to go too far in the past. We can see them fairly quickly. But yes, it's really interesting to looking what happened historically as well.
There was another question that I had regarding the ability to detect these earthquakes at different distances. Mm-hmm. So for the more recent quake that was last week, I've heard about how it can actually be detected all the way as far as the East Coast. Is that true?
Yes, the earthquake was recorded on stations all around the world, basically in U.S., in the continent, in the lower 48, on stations in South America, in Africa, in Europe, Australia. These large earthquakes will be recorded all around the globe.
How long do those quakes take to travel the waves from those earthquakes? How long do those take to travel to those really far away stations?
So we measure the distances when we look at earthquake locations. We measure the distances in degrees, and basically to get the full global coverage, it takes about a good 25 minutes, 30 minutes.
So you're telling me that the wave from an earthquake flagged around the world in 25 minutes?
Basically, yes.
What kind of speed is that? I mean, that's that's really fast.
The slowest sedimentary speeds, let's say, and those are the rocks closer to the surface. Within those sediments, the wave travels at about 2 kilometers per second.
That makes me wonder, how similar is that to the speed of sound?
Speed of sound, a lot slower. Speed of sound is about 330 meters per second.
So it's going at like Mach 6?
I would not know what Mach is, but...
Mach is one times the speed of sound, and Mach 2 would be 2 times the speed of sound.
So if you think about it, a speed of sound is 330 meters per second versus 2,000 meters per second. Yeah, it's 6 times as fast.
that's really something. So how useful is that information that you get from the furthest stations around the globe? How many stations do you need to get an accurate picture of the earthquake, the location, the magnitude, and the depth?
That all depends if you have close by stations, because then the early data will tell you very well your location and your depth. The differences between the P's and S's helps you constrain the depth of the earthquake. All the additional data, those are different kind of arrivals. Those are different, let's say, reflections and refractions and travel times through the Earth. They help you confirm the location, but you don't really need them for the location. But it helps to have a confirmation that everything is fitting the predicted travel times.
I see. So how evidently the USGS got information about the location, the depth, the time, and the intensity about the earthquake. But for a large earthquake like that 8.2 magnitude one, how are those studied long term, and what information are you using to study those earthquakes after the event?
So there are other branches of the USGS that study, or other people even without the geohazards branch, that will study in detail the mechanisms, the fault modeling, how much of the fault has slipped and what was the direction and how big is the aftershock zone. So how much of the fault broke during the earthquake. All of that information will be studied in detail, but that's not done by my group right here. This group here focuses on get the earthquake out, get the correct location, depth, and magnitude, the correct warning to people who need it, and when that's complete, we move on to the next earthquake. And earthquakes are coming in constantly. There is never really a break from earthquakes coming in, so you're constantly working response events. They might not be magnitude 8.2, but they might be a magnitude 6. We had a few weeks back in Walker, California, there was a magnitude 6.0. There might be just a magnitude 2.5 in the northeastern U.S. that are felt as well. So this office constantly works as the earthquakes come in. The research part is then done by a different folks from us and different groups.
I see. So how often do you have, events that you'd characterize as being similar to that large 8.2 magnitude earthquake?
Well, usually on average, you might have a magnitude 8 once a year. Not every year that I have seen has had magnitude 8. And then in comparison this year, this is the second magnitude 8 that we have had. The first one was in the Kermadec area. So on average, you will see about one a year.
How often do you see them in areas that are more populated than this part of Alaska?
Now, that is a That's a hard question. I could tell you how many magnitude 8 and larger happened in the last couple hundred years in Alaska, but as to how many magnitude 8s we see in populated areas, that's a hard one.
Fair enough. Here's another strange question. I'm sure you must have heard variations of this question throughout your career, but I grew up in the Seattle area, and people there in Seattle have been saying for a long time that one day, as part of, like, you know, this cycle, there will be a hypothetical big one that will shake up the whole coast. Is there any sort of actual scientific grounding to a statement like that, or is it mostly just local hearsay?
There is actually a research that has been done along the Pacific Northwest, and the research was done based on, I believe, people looked at geology. They looked at deposits and how trees in the history, in the past, how they died, and determined approximately from those observations that about 300-400 years ago, there was a massive earthquake along the coast of the Pacific Northwest. And since it is still a subduction zone, the Juan de Fuca plate is subducting underneath the North American plate in that location. It could be that the event could be repeated, but again, we cannot predict it.
So, and we're running down our time here pretty well. But another question that I had is, you know, if you have a major quake like this, like an 8.2 magnitude earthquake, and it can be detected around the world, how interrelated is sort of the ecosystem of these different plates that are always moving in conflict with one another? Is it sort of that you can have an event in Alaska that can trigger other events around the world, or vice versa? How do they all interact on the grander scheme?
So we have seen, when we have our large earthquakes, we have seen uptick in earthquakes elsewhere. But whether they are, how they are related and how the energy moves between them, that's sort of a question I haven't gotten an answer for. But what we do see is that once you have a magnitude 8, or in some cases even a large magnitude 7, you can see afterwards larger earthquakes happening elsewhere around the globe.
Okay. I think that's the short and tall of all my questions. Is there anything that you feel that I haven't asked you that's pertinent to this subject, or anything that you feel that you've left unsaid?
I think we covered pretty well, yeah.
Okay, well, thanks again for coming on. This has been another episode of KMXT 100.1 FM's Talk of the Rock, and thank you so much for joining us, Jana.
Thank you.